beach easy.
I was 18, 19 in that era. You know, everybody else was partying. So to me, it was just a party, but it was a cleaner, legal party. I wasn't buying something off the street. I wasn't drinking before my time. And so I thought if it comes from a doctor in a pharmacy, there's nothing wrong with it. My dad didn't say much. He just would say, son, be careful. But my mom, every time I saw her, it seemed like she was had something to say about it. And had something to say about it. You're taking too many. Stop. I want you to stop taking those things. You can watch any documentary or movie about an addict, and that's exactly right. There's no hiding it from anybody if you're in the same, under the same roof with these people, you know.
Welcome to Life's a Beach and Then You Die. From personal growth and self-discovery to challenges and victories, we discuss it all. Join us as we dive into the extraordinary stories of ordinary people all the way to the end.
Welcome to Life's a Beach and Then You Die. I'm Julie, and today I'm with James Scott Bullard, a musician who used to perform here in the Myrtle Beach area and all across the country. The life of an artist is always full of twists and turns, and Scott's story certainly has those. It all started back when he was a kid and found himself often sick.
I started showing symptoms of Crohn's disease, but back then, keep in mind, 1982, 83, nobody knew what that was. The doctors, especially in small towns or even in bigger, you know, like South Carolina period, had no clue. It just wasn't a big thing. They didn't know yet. Mm-hmm. And so most of the doctors, especially in the small town, were just like, oh, he just doesn't want to go to school. Make him go. So my dad would force me to go. But I was actually really sick, like deathbed sick. And so he kept this guilt for having pushed me, now that I have a son, I can put myself in that position and say, mm-hmm. I would feel bad too. You know, I made him go when he was not able to go.
How did you know he felt bad? Did he just tell
you? Oh, yeah,
you?
Yeah.
You talked
about
it?
Well, I got a free pass a lot in my later teen years.
When you probably didn't need him.
Yeah. Yeah. But that was why, because he felt so bad about what having it. But I didn't abuse it. I didn't even realize it until later. And then we talked. He did say it out loud. He did say that, I feel bad because I didn't. I was like, you shouldn't, I didn't think about it.
Yeah. He didn't know.
No. I mean, how could you? How could you? The daughters didn't know. How was you supposed to know? The night that I had to go to Chapel Hill where they found the problem. And they found it in 10 minutes. When I walked in the door, the doctors, I was sitting on the table with the paper on it, and two doctors walked in, and they weren't in there 10 minutes before they walked out and told my parents he's got Crohn's disease. Mm. Vast difference between a small town and a university town, I guess.
Yeah.
And once that, I think he felt, and he also felt a little bit like he wasn't there, but he couldn't be because he was going through his own problems, and it was the worst possible time for all that to happen.
Yeah.
Despite his health issues, Scott found a passion for music. It was something deep inside him that was always going to be a big part of his life.
My dad and his brothers had a band, and they were all musically inclined. My grandfather used to play a harmonica with his cup of coffee every morning and tap this giant foot he had on the floor. My dad played guitar and sang beautifully, and I had an uncle who had a chance to go actually play lead for Merle Haggard, but turned it down to come home and get married. I never figured that out.
Oh, no.
But anyway, my cousins, it skipped them all. None of them were musically inclined, none of them. But me, it landed on. And it landed by way of just kind of being around it, I think. But I was playing Little League. First time I'd ever done in any kind of sport. But my mom wanted me to do something, And so My dad bought the glove and the ball and the whole nine, thinking, okay, he's going to play baseball. Cool. And then a buddy of mine came for a sleepover, and he brought Quiet Riot, Mental Health, and Ozzy Osbourne's Randy Rhoads tribute with him. And we listened to those, and that was the end of it. I had to have a guitar after that.
Yeah.
Fast forward a bit was when I had the first girlfriend a couple years later, maybe. And she bought me for Christmas one year, Black Sabbath, We Sold Our Soul for Rock and Roll record. Around the same time, I decided to quit school. So I had nothing to do all day but sit around and listen to those records and learn. And I learned the Black Sabbath back to front. Like I just, you know, knew it like my hand. And so that was kind of the downward spiral right there.
How did you get away with quitting school? What'd your parents say about that?
My mom was hit the roof because her dad was an educator. You know, her dad was a principal and a school teacher.
How old were you then?
16.
You just didn't go?
Yeah, well, it started as just kind of, I think it started all with the Crohn's thing. Like, you know, I had to stay out so much that I got used to staying out. You know, I got used to just doing my own thing when I was home on the days that I wasn't in excruciating pain. So when it came down to, you know, sitting home and doing my own thing and, you know, like, or going to school, getting up that early in the morning and following rules and just hell with that. You know, that was just my general attitude. And so in 10th grade, I just decided it's not for me. And oddly enough, my mom took me to the doctor. It was for an appointment. It wasn't like she took me to the doctor for this, but and she was telling the doctor while we were there about the situation, like he wants to quit school. And he said to her, school just isn't for some people.
Wow.
You know, maybe it's not for him. And I think she was expecting him to go, oh, you got to stay in school, buddy. You know, like he didn't. He just like said, well, maybe.
Interesting. You know?
And so, yeah, that was a situation where my dad's, you know, stepped in and said, nah, would you rather fight him every day? You know, every morning, or would you rather just let's go on with life and let him stop as long as he promises to go get his diploma? And I did. And I did. I promised and I went and did it, you know, went to night school. And so, but that was so much easier to me than getting up every day and following rules. I just went to night school, sat at a table with a bunch of other people and did a workbook. And then at the end of it, you took a test and you were gone.
His unique childhood experiences of being sick, leaving high school, and pursuing music all culminated when he was 18 into something that would follow him for the rest of his life.
I had been in and out of emergency rooms for 3 or 4 years before they found what was wrong. And all they know to do is give you something for pain and send you home. We can't fix it. We don't know what it is. So here's some Demerol. Here's some morphine. See you later. Hmm. And you start getting, you know, at that age, it's not so much the escape that the drug gives you. It's more that, well, this fixed every problem I had.
Hmm.
You know, I didn't actually start using until I was 18. Hmm. And it was because I found a doctor that I call a Hank Williams doctor who would just give you whatever you asked for as long as you put a paycheck. I mean, paid her. And so when it was that readily available, of course I did it.
Were you thoughtful about it, or did you just one day do it, or did you need it at one time?
I did it
one, so you started it up?
I'd hurt my back skateboarding. I took a nasty fall and landed on my hip, which caused a hip issue and a back issue and, you know, all kind of things. And oddly enough, she was the doctor I saw in the emergency room, because then they didn't have back then, they didn't have the doctors that did their rounds in, you know, an emergency room. And then she was just a local doctor, and then she would go to the emergency room at night. I started going to her and they just kept coming, and I didn't say no. I could have, you know, I don't blame her. I don't blame anybody but me. Never did. You know, did I know that I was doing something wrong? Sure.
Yeah.
I knew that I wasn't.
But you're also really young.
I was 18, 19 in that era, and I was, you know, everybody else was partying. So to me, it was just a party, but it was a cleaner, legal party. I wasn't buying something off the street. I wasn't drinking before my time. I was just doing something that the doctor gave me. So it's okay. Again, that functioning alcoholic thing my dad had where it doesn't stop me from this, it's okay. Yeah. And so I thought if it comes from a doctor in a pharmacy, there's nothing wrong with it. It's fine.
Did your parents notice?
Oh, God, yeah, they knew. They knew. I mean, who you think was paying the bill? I wasn't.
What did they do about it?
They raised hell about it a lot. My dad didn't say much. He just would say, son, be careful. Just be careful with that. But my mom, every time I saw her, it seemed like she had something to say about it. You're taking too many. You're taking too many. Stop taking this. Stop. I want you to stop taking those things. I want you, you know, I'm fine. You know, you can watch any documentary or movie about an addict, and that's exactly right. You know, there's no hiding. There's no hiding it from anybody if you're under the same roof with these people. You know, it got so bad throughout, though, because I didn't stop until I was 34, 18 to 34. And I didn't, it just kept getting worse. I mean, like, you know, you're taking them on label like you're supposed to at first. And then you're going through, you know, 240 a month I never wanted to go to the top. Something in my head said, stay back here because you can at least go there if you get cancer or something. You know, like there was, that sounds terrible. But in my head, I was like, if you get really a problem, you're not going to be able to kill the pain. So I thought, just stay away from the top and you'll be okay. And there was a part of me too that always said, stay away from things like, you know, crack and heroin, because if somebody ever writes a book about you, those things just don't shine a good light.
Oh,
but no,
you're so conscientious.
Yeah, it was strange what you're conscientious about. So I would go to the doctor, and it got to a point where I didn't even have to go in for a visit. I would just call, and they knew what I was coming for. Once a month, I would have to go in and slide a check across the counter, and they'd slide me the prescription, and I'd walk out the door. I was there like maybe 2 minutes.
This was his routine, what he was used to, until he reached a turning point.
I'm not going to sit here and tell you some lie that, you know, I had my child and I had this epiphany. That's not true. The truth of it is my doctor got busted.
Oh.
And I went to another doctor shopping, and I went to another doctor and another doctor and another doctor, and they all said the same thing. No, I'm not doing it. As soon as they would look at my chart and see who my doctor was, they knew what I was coming through the door for.
Yeah.
Because they had hundreds of us in that town. She was running a pill mill. Well, I can't say she was doing it. There's a whole backstory to that. But it had to do with making money.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, it was a conscious thing after that. After she got busted, it was a conscious thing that, okay, I can spend the rest of my life looking over my shoulder and doctor shopping and trying to find a doctor who'll write me one and then two and then three and whatever and going to the next doctor. I can do that because a lot of people do it. Or I've got a kid now. I can finally straighten my shit up and do what I need to do. And that was the obvious choice, because continuing to go that route was going to end only in two ways. And so my dad's doctor, and my dad had already died at this point, but my dad's doctor was almost like a family friend. In fact, my dad would go to, you know, he had a hunting lodge he would go to, and he would invite my dad. Like, they were buddies, you know. And I thought he was the one that was going to save me. I don't know where that came from, but in my mind, that's who I needed to see. And so I went to him, and I told him the whole sordid story. And he said, well, and he was a straight shooter. He said, damn. He said, you're in trouble. He said, you've gotten yourself in a mess, but we can get you out of it. And he walked out of his office, and he got on the phone, and he called the rehab clinic, and he said, told him the whole story. And he said, when can you get me a bed? And they said, it's going to be next Thursday. And he said, okay. He came back in the room. He said, you're going in next Thursday. I'm going to write you enough pills so that you don't withdraw before you get there. If you come back to me, I'll never see you again. Fair enough. So he wrote me enough. I went home and mentally prepared, I thought, for what I was about to encounter. And that next Thursday I went and walked through the doors of rehab, and they said, what'd you take today? And I told them. And they did all the blood tests and everything, and my liver enzymes were great, which is unbelievable because they should have been Swiss cheese after all that. And I stayed for 3 days and came out completely clean.
Oh, wow. What were those 3 days like? Were you like—
The first one was terrifying.
Yeah.
The next two were not that bad. I mean, the next two were group meetings and, you know, getting up when I wasn't used to getting up. In fact, I was used to going to bed at 6 a.m. Now they had you getting up at 6 a.m. And I saw that as just a part of the change that I was going through. I had to change everything. I couldn't do any of the same things, you know. A lot of my addiction was boredom. You know, like a lot of, that was my trigger, was boredom, having nothing to do. You know, we'll, you know, idle hands, you know. And so my mom came to pick me up from rehab, and they told her that, you know, we give every patient a rating, like, you know, on a scale of 1 to 100. And if they, you know, if they're a 50, they might be back. If they're a 30, they're coming back tomorrow. You know, they rated me at a 96.
Mm.
And they were like, we don't know how, but in 3 days' time, he figured out that he's just not doing it again. And so oddly enough, as I told you before, my dad was the same way. I quit drinking. I quit smoking. And he just quit. He just quit because he was tired of it, I guess. He was tired of, he knew that the cigarettes had probably caused part of his heart disease. He knew that the drinking had caused it. He knew that he was not able to go to work that particular day because the drinking had stopped him. And so he just gave up and gave up those bad things. And from that point forward, he and my mom had a good life. And from the time I came out of rehab until just recently, everything was hunky dory. It was after I got out of rehab that my life started to change for the better, as far as my career, because part of my spinning my wheels, I was creating content, but the reason I was spinning my wheels and not going anywhere as far as, like, you know, where I saw myself going was that, you know, chain around my ankle of the drug abuse.
Getting his drug abuse under control allowed him to pursue music in a more effective way. He was able to connect with himself and music and eventually found the music that he wanted to create.
So I was kind of like in a career limbo. I didn't know what to do. I knew I wanted to continue to make music, and I went to Wilmington. A family friend had a house they loaned for me to stay in till I got my shit together. And I stayed and hung out around Wilmington and Monkey Junction and all those areas in there. And everybody kept telling me about this guy. It was in Jacksonville. And his name was Ryan Adams. And they said, you got to hear this. Like, he's just a songwriter, and it's amazing. And, you know, I don't know. I was kind of coming off the heels of hard rock. I wanted something new. And hadn't heard it. But I finally heard it, and I was absolutely dumbstruck by this guy. The songwriting, the ability he had to maintain rock, you know, as far as, like, the lifestyle and the look. But the music he was playing was kind of country. You know, yeah. It was kind of thought-provoking, and it was kind of like Bob Dylan meets Willie Nelson somehow. You know, like, I don't know. Yeah. Anyway, I heard that, and that was kind of a different – that was a reason right there, like, to try something new, because he was the same age as I was, and he was from a small town, you know. So that's kind of the path I set on. And then I was dating this girl, and she bought me a Graham Parsons record. And Graham was kind of like the godfather of country rock. You know, he hated that term, but that's what they called it, you know.
Right.
In fact, some of his band members became the Eagles, you know.
Yep.
So, you know, I started taking it all in. And then that sent me back to my dad, Waylon and Willie and Merle and all that. And I started seeing this amazing songwriting, like, from Merle Haggard. Just these lyrics were so simple, but they were so punch in the gut, you know, like things he would say. And Willie Nelson, like, you know, Kris Kristofferson, these were poets. You know, they weren't hicks, you know.
Right.
And so I started just taking it all in, like I did with the rock stuff. I started taking it all in. And I never turned my back on rock and metal, because I still love them to this day. But I took a different route and started writing that, and ended up writing the meat and potatoes of my first two records in Wilmington within a month's time. Just because the inspiration was so,
oh wow,
you know, it just came. Like, you know, I had nothing to do all day but get up in the morning, drink coffee, and write and listen to these great new things I had discovered. They weren't new to anybody else, but they were new to me. Mm-hmm. And with rock, it's a little different. Like, you can say, you can get deep, you know, you can have, but you don't have to, you know, like, so why would you? Just focus on the heavy music and get your message out there and be done. But with this stuff, it's lighter. It's, you know, you're actually hearing what he says. And so you make sure you damn well you say something. You know, and so I just kind of became a student of those guys, you know, Townes Van Zandt and Kristofferson and Blaze Foley and all these amazing, amazing songwriters who weren't rock. They weren't quite country. You didn't know where to put them. You know, you didn't know. So they, I guess the term that best described what I was doing and they were doing was Americana.
Yeah.
Which I thought at the time was what John Mellencamp did. But no, that's rock. Okay. So, you know, it just, it's odd to me how those names, labels, I never wanted to attach to a label, but sometimes you just don't have a choice because people want to put you in a box.
Well, they do. And a record store and a Spotify need to know how to, where to stick you.
Sure. Sure. Yeah. And so, once I started doing Americana, I got more attention from that than I did the hard rock band. And I thought maybe I was just on the wrong path all the time. I don't know. I don't know how that happened. I don't know if it was just because I was older and sober, or if it was because I was more focused. I was terrified by the band splitting up and not knowing what was going to happen next. There could have been several factors, but I don't think I pushed any harder. I may have. I mean, I was alone, so I could easily book shows without having to check with four other people, or, you know, it was easy to maintain just yourself.
Well, tell me about your lifestyle then. So I know you're on the road a lot. And was it sex, drugs, and rock and roll? Like, explain that to me.
It's everything you've ever heard about it. Or it can be. It's what you want it to be.
Yeah.
You know, I know guys that go to bed at 8 every night if there's no show, and they're up in the morning and they go and do, you know, try to, whatever city they're in, they try to see the sights. And I was live by night. I never saw the sights, you know, rarely. I did see some. But most of the time with the way I was living, and I'm sure a lot of people who are doing it and have done it will know this, what I'm saying is you see the back end of the venue, you see the motel, and you see nighttime. You know, you don't get a chance to.
And were you partying then? Were you drinking or doing anything?
No, I was sober, but so on the last tour, my sobriety began to teeter. And I don't know why. I honestly don't know why. I can't pinpoint something that happened that was negative or even positive that would cause me to start celebrating or escaping. But there was some reason.
Was it boredom? Had you been doing that sort of thing for a long enough time that you just felt bored?
I don't even think it was boredom. I mean, because it was, you know what I think? I do know how it started. Thinking back, I remember there was a, when I was not touring, when I was in between tours and I was home, I would do stuff to stay in shape, like boxing. I had a punching bag, and I constantly was boxing. And I had a bad shoulder impingement because I had overextended myself. Then, on the set of a music video, I was on a ladder to see if the car we had borrowed a guy's 1960-something Chevy Chevelle. It was so beautiful. And I had got on the ladder to make sure that it was going to be in frame the way I wanted it to pass under the camera. And when I came down, I overextended my leg and by proxy, my sciatic nerve. And so now I have a sciatic nerve problem and an overextended shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
So I go to the doctor and how much they can do about it, but give you something for pain and send you back home. Well, they did. And I'll tell you what I learned in rehab, not to be sober, but to control, you know, yourself.
Right.
And wrangle things in, because I didn't know how. I had no, my philosophy was if one's good, 20's better.
Right.
Of anything. You know. Anything I liked, I overdid it. I guess that was what started it, because I had something readily available. And then you're traveling, you're in sitting all the time because you're in a car. And you're riding 16 hours and 10 hours and 8 hours and even 4 hours, even 2 hours is too long for me sometimes, you know. And if you have a bad back and you have, it's going to hurt worse. So you just take a couple things and just keep yourself going, you know. You're living on, you know, truck stop hot dogs and bananas and water and on to the next. And then you get to the venue and they feed you most of the time. Good meals, you know. And then you have your days off, which are boring. It can be. And most of the time, we slept the day away. Like, I would have a driver. If I didn't have an opening act, I would have a driver because I hated to drive. But it was always somebody I knew, somebody I trusted, who could not just drive but help me get the stuff in and out, you know, like whatever. But we all kept the same hours. So we would, you know, go to sleep as the sun's coming up, and then you wake up at night and, well, there's nothing to do but sit here in the motel. So we ended up watching like Forensic Files and playing cards and things like that, you know, for hours on end. But then you got to go to sleep. How do you get sleep if you can't sleep? You get something to help you sleep. And then I started taking, like, you know, people were there at the shows and they would, let me buy a shot. And I would always say, no, I'm clean, you know, I'm sober, I appreciate it, but no. One day I just said, yeah, sure. And that next night turned into, sure, yeah, I'll have another. And then the next night, and I found myself eventually buying a bottle of Jim Beam to go on the next trip with. And we'd get back to the motel and take another couple of shots. And it's only a couple of shots. It ain't going to hurt. But I'd probably popped a couple of pain pills before it. You know, nobody knew this was happening. Like, I didn't tell my manager. I didn't tell any family members, any friends. Even the people that were traveling with me had no clue. I mean, they knew I was drinking, but they just saw me taking a couple of shots here and there. That's not a big deal.
And what age-ish did that, like, restart?
Oh, that was in my 40s. That was just recently, yeah.
Yeah.
That was, I stopped touring in 2020. I stopped touring three months before COVID happened.
So you were older, you'd been through that. And then
it just kind of happened again, you know, like, but having had sickness and health issues my entire life, I knew that at some point I was going to have to be on some medication again that may or may not be detrimental to my sobriety. But like I said, rehab just taught me how to stay in control. You know, don't take 15, take exactly what the bottle says and back away, you know.
Well, control, that's the difference between an addict and somebody who's not. That's all
sure,
it is.
Sure, sure. And that was what I had to learn. And yeah. So now at the ripe old age of 50, I still have, you know, I have osteoarthritis, terrible. And so I have prescriptions for painkillers, but I know how to stay away from it when it's just, I'm bored now. Mm. There are days, especially recently, when I find myself way too attracted to the drawer or to the cabinet or to wherever they are, you know. But yeah, it's that game you play. It's a game. I'm not saying that to make light of it. It's not a game, but it's a game to the person that's within it. It's a game between you and that bottle, you know, or that whatever, that needle or whatever you're on. It's a game, you know, hide and seek. Like, who's gonna, you know, are you gonna find me today? You know, that kind of, it's that kind of thing. And there's this fear and excitement. I'd be a liar if I didn't say that it was kind of exciting because, you know what's on the other end of that. You know, you know how good it feels. You know that it takes everything away. You know that it's going to, but it doesn't, you know.
Right, it doesn't.
You know at the same time that it doesn't. It's just going to be a momentary thing, you know. And then you're going to wake up in the same body with a worse problem, you know. So, yeah, it's a constant
fight. Or a worse body.
It's a
worse
constant
body
fight.
With a worse problem.
Yeah, I'd love to be Mr. Tough Guy and say that I walked out of rehab after 3 days and never looked back. But that's not true. I walked out of rehab after 3 days, didn't look back for many, many, many years, you know, and then slipped, then got back on track. And now I'm sitting on the, you know, center of the seesaw. You know, it could go either way. Like, but I know that. Mm-hmm. Before I didn't have that knowledge.
He got his addiction under control once again and continued touring. He was making enough money to live off of. His career was going well, but his soul felt tired.
In early 2020, or maybe late 2019. The dates are fuzzy, but I remember I was on the road. I was in, I think I was somewhere in Mississippi, I think. And I couldn't do it anymore. Physically, emotionally, mentally, and there was just something saying, this is the end. You've got to stop this. And I wasn't in like the throes of addiction and I didn't have any debts. I mean, it wasn't nothing like that. It was literally, I didn't have any, you know, wife and kids at home. I mean, I had a kid, but he and I saw each other when I came home and we, you know, we had a good relationship. So it wasn't one of those things where something was going on that I needed, that needed more attention. It was, I just literally couldn't do it anymore. My health had started to fail somewhat. I had not yet been diagnosed with osteoarthritis. I'd had one more bout with Crohn's disease when I was 35. And then after that, it never bothered me again. Mine always pops up every 20 years. But my health was not good. And was it due to that I was drinking more? And you know, like, yeah, probably. And I wasn't, you're not healthy. Like, you're not living healthy. You're eating hot dogs and, you know, bread. And, you know, I mean, it's not a healthy lifestyle. It's not like, you know, I wasn't getting up every morning and doing yoga by any means. Yeah, I just something just had, I had to stop. And I think what I intended to do was stop for a while, get a breath, come up for air, and then reassess myself. I honestly think it was a midlife crisis. That's what I think it was, because I was 47, 45, getting close to 50. Like, I knew it was coming, and I knew that there was the probability of me continuing on. Like, I knew other musicians that were still doing it in their 70s. I knew them personally, but was I going to do that? I don't know, man. That just didn't seem attractive to me. Like, continuing to go out and...
Were you getting tired of it? Tired of singing the same songs?
Yes, I think I was. I think I was burning out. I think I was not just burning out, but again, the midlife crisis thing. Mine was not finding a 20-year-old girlfriend in a Corvette. Mine was getting the hell out of whatever I was in.
Yeah.
You know, finding a new way. Little did I know, life had other plans.
2020 was a defining year for a lot of people. At first, it was a time of rest and recuperation for Scott, but his priorities in life quickly shifted.
My mom had a back issue, and she's 85 at the time, and 84. And she says, I'm going to have to get this checked out. She goes to the doctor. He says that surgery's, you know, necessary, Well, that's also right before COVID happened. So when COVID happened, because it wasn't an emergency, her surgery got put off for a year, which gave the back time to get worse and worse and worse. Well, what I didn't know and what nobody could see was her mental state was getting worse and worse. She finally, after a year into it, she finally was able to go to surgery. They called her in and told her they could do the surgery. She went, and when she came out of the surgery, her mental decline was much worse. And I talked to my doctor, who was also her family doctor, and said, told him what was going on. He said, well, there's something called hospital psychosis, and she's been in and out of the hospital for a few times now, and, you know, also with the sedative and, you know, they have to use for surgery, it can, especially in elderly people, it can cause this. So I waited with bated breath to see if it was those things, but it wasn't. It kept going and kept going. And finally, the be-all, end-all was she had Lewy body dementia, which is bad, you know. And she gave me power of attorney without my knowing it. So when I found that out, I jumped on taking care of everything and getting her affairs, you know, as in order as I could get, dealing with her business. And keep in mind, my whole life had been with people who took care of it for me, either my dad or a manager. I had no clue how to do real life. No clue. And so here I am with this thrown in my lap, you know, a sick elderly woman who can't take care of herself anymore, who is bedbound 100% and has the mentality of maybe a 5-year-old.
This is not where Scott saw himself in his 50s. It's not where anyone sees themselves. The pain of losing someone while they're still with you is complicated. With all the grief and stress of trying to care for someone you love who's been rendered helpless, it's easy to feel like you're failing and there's no hope. But Scott fights hard against letting that hopelessness take hold.
You know what? I still have a hopeful outlook. I do. Despite it all, I still have moments where I say, well, I don't know what the future is yet. And that to me is a little comforting because I don't know that it's not going to be okay. I know that it's not now, but it hasn't been before. So maybe, you know, maybe one of those lights is not a train. You know, maybe one of those lights is coming to help, you know, like maybe, I don't know. I don't think you can maintain your humanity and not have some form of hope because you know that there's always a day when there's a night. You know that. So that's kind of where I put my hope, is that tomorrow will come. Now, I might not wake up tomorrow, but it'll still come. You know, like, that's how you have to look at it. Like, you know, you don't know. You don't know. And that's part of the beauty of life, is the mystery. You know, I don't know what tomorrow brings. And that's why I love it. And I don't know what tomorrow brings. And that's why I hate it.
You never know what's coming next in your life. All you can do is hold on and try to be the best person you can. It takes a strong and caring person to take care of someone full time while still choosing hope. And though as life is hard right now, if we've learned anything from life, it's that it's always changing. And the hope for the future that Scott has, that's what will get him to tomorrow.
If you've been inspired by this story or any others, please take a moment to subscribe, rate, and review.
We don't just get away at the beach, we get together. Because no matter what floats your boat, we're floating right along with you. With over 2,000 restaurants, live music all day and night, and endless attractions, Myrtle Beach was made for having fun and beaching easy. Welcome to 60 miles where you belong, the beach. Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Plan your trip at visitmyrtlebeach.com.